5 years ago this month, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers descended on a kosher meatpacking plant in the northeast Iowa town of Postville. It was the largest immigration raid in Iowa's history. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Postville raid resulted in the deportation of over 300 people and a hail of criticism over how it was carried out. This hour, we look back on the raid with several guests, how it affected the community of Postville and the families involved, and its relevance to the ongoing debate over comprehensive immigration reform in Washington. The Postville raid, 5 years later. First, this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On May 12, 2008, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers descended on a kosher meatpacking plant in the northeast Iowa town of Postville. It was the largest immigration raid in Iowa's history and resulted in the deportation of over 300 people. This hour, we look back on that raid, also how it affected the community of Postville and the families involved. But first, an overview of why it came about and how the raid was carried out. My first guest is Barbara Schwartz. She is clinical professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, and Barbara Schwartz focuses on immigration law. Welcome to our program, Barbara.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, what led ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau, to plan and carry out this raid?
I think there are some questions even about that 5 years later. It's clear that this was in the planning for some time before the actual raid, because as we learned later, a lot of people had been advised that there was going to be this massive arrest with federal charges. So
a lot of people, but not people at the meatpacking plant. Who had been advised?
Well, people who were going to be likely to be responsible for representing the workers. So there were folks who played a substantial role in representing indigents in the federal court in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Why was Postville selected?
It probably was an easy target. I don't think it was a big secret at the time that there were significant numbers of undocumented people working there.
Mm-hmm. In hindsight, 5 years on now, what have been the chief criticisms of the raid and how it was carried out and how the people who were arrested were prosecuted?
All right. I think the chief criticism was the procedures or lack of them that were used. So there was a decision made that they were going to have these expedited procedures in place so that they could process as many of these workers as they could with as little difficulty.
And it was all set up at the Cattle Congress grounds in Waterloo.
Right, right. And they moved the court, which usually sits in Cedar Rapids, to Waterloo, and they appointed counsel, basically represented large numbers of defendants at the same time. There were criticisms of the particular plea bargains that were offered. It was like the perfect storm of events.
Now, I understand one of the criticisms is that previously undocumented workers were simply charged with being in the country illegally, and not with what many of them were in fact charged with: identity theft, document fraud. That was a departure, wasn't it?
It was. And the reason it could happen was that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Iowa in the jurisdiction, had interpreted the federal identity theft statute in such a way that it made it very easy to prosecute anybody who had used a number that didn't belong to them in the employment process. And it had a mandatory minimum sentence, and so it put on enormous pressure on the workers to take the plea bargain, which was offered, and that was that they could take, they would plead guilty to a lesser charge and do 6 months in federal custody, which they all took. It turned out later that the Eighth Circuit was an outlier. After Postville, the Supreme Court reversed the Eighth Circuit unanimously, and today they couldn't have done it in quite that way. They could not have offered those plea bargains because they couldn't prove identity theft against the workers.
And wasn't it the case, too, and also a criticism that the individuals charged were charged with crimes they didn't necessarily understand?
Well, that too.
How so?
Well, they were almost uniformly Spanish speakers. Some didn't even speak Spanish. Some of the Guatemalan workers spoke indigenous languages. I don't think anybody had time to explain to them. There was one of the events that was subject to a lot of discussion, at least in the immigration bar, was the fact that the accused were inaccessible to immigration counsel. So there couldn't be any determination made about whether they might have some relief within the immigration system, some entitlement to some benefit that they were giving up with the guilty pleas.
What was the U.S. District Attorney's interest in doing this raid, in carrying out this raid in the fashion that it did?
Well, I think the Justice Department has a significant interest in controlling illegal immigration. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. And in fact, since the raid, the Obama administration has been very aggressive, not in quite the same fashion, but in ferreting out illegal immigration in order to set the stage, I think, for immigration reform. So it's hard to say there wasn't a significant governmental interest in detecting illegal immigration. I think much of the criticism of the raid has been not that the raid took place in the abstract, but in the way that it was done.
Why do you think the U.S. District Attorney's Office acted so aggressively in this prosecution, in this case in Postville?
I don't know. I mean, the U.S. Attorney's Office took the position that they were requested, or that the direction came from Washington, from the Justice Department. Spokespeople for the Justice Department in Washington said no. So I don't know what the truth is, to be honest with you.
Barbara Schwartz, can you see the relevance that this raid has now, 5 years on, to the ongoing debate over comprehensive immigration reform in Washington?
Well, one of the things that it did demonstrate, the raid itself, not necessarily the procedures, which was one of the big criticisms, was that we had these folks who wanted to work to improve their lives and the lives of their children, and we had these jobs that needed filling, and the raid just sort of emphasized that there was something fundamentally wrong with our system, where we could have this need for workers. The workers wanted to work, and yet we didn't have a system that would accommodate them.
The workers wanted to work. We needed their services. There weren't others to do this, and the system failed.
Exactly. And so comprehensive immigration reform addresses that to some extent by providing for temporary workers who just would like to come here, work, make decent wages, and go home. Now, whether that would take into account all the people that were arrested and ended up being deported, it's hard to say. And it also creates a way for people who have been here for a significant period of time, haven't broken the law other than by being in the country without documentation, and then giving them a path to citizenship, a very long and arduous path, but a path nonetheless.
Barbara Schwartz focuses on immigration law in her position as clinical professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Barbara Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we're looking back at the raid by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers of the U.S. government on a kosher meatpacking plant in northeast Iowa in the town of Postville. It's already been 5 years since that happened, May 12th, 2008, the largest immigration raid in Iowa's history, resulting in the deportation of over 300 people. Joining me now with two perspectives on that day and the aftermath, Sonia Paras is with us, an immigration lawyer who represented around 200 people in relation to the Postville raid. Sonia, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us, Bob Teig, a former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Iowa at the time of the Postville raid. Bob Teig was involved with the planning of the raid and with the prosecution. Bob Teig, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Ben.
And we wanted someone from the U.S. attorney currently at the attorney's office of the Northern District of Iowa, but they were unable to comment due to an upcoming trial. Bob, let's have you start us off with your perspective on this. Before the raid, before raid day, May 12, 2008, what did you know about the Postville plant?
Well, what's been disclosed is that there were probably about 600 workers there, which was the vast majority of the workforce. They weren't undocumented. They had documents, but they were all false. So we had people who were illegally in the country and illegally using other people's Social Security numbers. In fact, I think at one point it was tracked down at least one person who had some problems with Social Security because wages were reported and they weren't theirs at another location. So we had those problems. So that information was developed over a period of several months.
Mm-hmm. And what was your knowledge before the raid and before the trial and so forth of how high up this manner of having undocumented workers with faked ID cards work?
Well, I think what's already been, again, disclosed, and I have to be careful, even though I don't work there anymore, I still have to be careful. I can't disclose attorney work product and confidential information. But what has been disclosed in court is that the initial enforcement action was strictly on the folks who were there illegally and were criminally using other people's identification falsely. Then it was developed as part of the information seized during the enforcement operation and as part of interviews that took place after that, that the involvement went right to the top.
Mm-hmm. I want to get Sonia's view on this in just a moment, but we heard from our first guest, Barbara Schwartz of the University of Iowa College of Law, that it's not that it happened, but the manner in which it happened. So talk about why the process was expedited, why the people were not simply deported, and why it all took place at the Cattle Congress in Waterloo.
Lots of things there, and if I miss things as I go, let me know. A lot of misinformation has been spouted. I found it interesting that Barbara, who had no involvement in the operation at the time or later on in the proceedings, so had no personal involvement, couched everything as there are complaints of. Yeah, by some people that just have no credibility. But let's go into the specifics. It was known that there were potentially about 600 defendants, and they only got about 300 because they went in one shift, and by the time the next shift came around, nobody showed up. So it was known it was going to be a huge operation, and the primary concern was being able to protect any accused person's rights, because someone who is arrested has an absolute right to be taken before a judicial officer without unnecessary delay. Now, if that would have had to have happened in Cedar Rapids, it would have taken days if it had been done at the federal courthouse. First, there weren't adequate facilities to properly detain people up until the time they had their hearing. There were not adequate personnel to handle those things, not adequate number of court interpreters or reporters, not an adequate number of judges, not an adequate number of courtrooms. So it just dictated that another site was necessary, and that was there were months of planning. That's been acknowledged. And those administrative details were planned for months. I think Barbara said there was some pre-disclosure of where the raid was going to be. That's not true. Even the attorneys that were brought in short, I believe that morning, the defense attorneys, to be told there was something going on, would they participate? They weren't told where it was until it happened. So, again, that kind of misinformation. But and the reason the Cattle Congress grounds were chosen is because there was a lot of very usable space, both in the grounds and buildings. Temporary buildings were brought in for attorneys to interview their clients and to have a place to work.
Bob, we have about 5 minutes before a break. I want to get Sonia in before the break, so a little back and forth if we could here. Sonia, you are an immigration lawyer. You represented around 200 people in the Postville raid. Take us through that day from your perspective with your concerns about the way in which it was conducted.
Based on our experience with the Marshalltown raid in 2006 and the fact that immigration attorneys and advocates were unable to access Camp Dutch and access detainees from that raid, we quickly learned that we needed to reorganize and to develop a rapid response team that could assist with social needs, with humanitarian needs for children that were left alone, for women that were pregnant and detained or nursing and undetained. And based on that, we developed a loose coalition of service providers that we called ISNET, Immigration Safety Network. We had three committees, media to inform people of what was happening, social to respond to those needs that I just mentioned, and legal to have a team of pro bono immigration lawyers available to detainees. We knew from a Marshalltown raid that the document G28, which is a document that allows immigration lawyers to enter their appearance as attorney or representatives, was one of the documents that we were going to need in order to access detainees. And based on all that past experience and our preparation for almost 2 years, you know, we were ready to help the day of the raid. As the chair of the pro bono legal committee, I received a courtesy call from ICE community outreach officer, which was very appreciated because when I got the call, I was told we're moving in, we're raiding Postville, is a large operation. And we were very thankful because this is how it was supposed to work. It was supposed to work this way. So,
It was all good up to that point, but you said access to the detainees was a problem a little bit later.
Yes, we came to the cattle grounds with 150 G28s with names and last names that allowed us to visit with our clients. And I don't think they knew what to do with us. I think we were not part of the plan, so we were taken to this FEMA trailer, piece of, I don't know, and we were there from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. We were not allowed to leave the trailer.
Without access to
anybody, anybody. And we were very upset because we knew that while we were there in that trailer, they were being questioned. They were questioning our clients, and we didn't have access to them.
Bob Tai, can you tell us what will happen that long period, that the entire day when they're in the FEMA trailer? What's going on with the detainees?
Well, I can tell you what was going on with the attorneys. They were eating pizza, and they left the place trashed when they left. But besides that, with the detainees, they were being administratively processed, name, country of residence, the family, that kind of thing. No criminal inquiries were done. It was all immigration processing to get the names and the files going. And also my understanding that first day, no one showed up with representation letters. That didn't help until the second day. And then all these attorneys were allowed to talk to whoever they wanted to. So misinformation. Sorry. And these attorneys could have gone to talk to these folks when they were housed in jails after, but they didn't.
Well, I was there physically when I came in with 150 documents. The first day, we were not allowed to go in because they were transporting people from the Postville agri-processor plant into Waterloo. So obviously, they were transporting people on that first day, and we were not allowed to go in. On the second day, bright and early, a group of seven lawyers were there with the letters. We never ate pizza. We were not allowed to leave the trailer, and we were hauled in there while they were questioning our clients, and we demanded to talk to our clients and have access to them, and we were denied access to them.
If I might ask you, Bob Teig, about the charges, aggravated identity theft here, why not simply deport that? And then I'd like to get a response from Sonia Paris before we have a break in about three minutes.
Sure. Those charges were filed because the facts and the law supported those charges. These people, according to the law as it existed, and not just in the Eighth Circuit, as Barbara alluded, seemed to allude to, but in other courts as well, had said you did not have to prove the element that the person knew the document was false. Well, these were made-up numbers. They had to know anyway. But the Supreme Court changed that interpretation that the Eighth Circuit had. So, again, it was easier to prove at that time, but the evidence supported those charges. That's why they were filed. That's always the practice. You file charges that you think you can support with the facts and the law. This wasn't any different. Those kind of charges have been prosecuted since in the Northern District of Iowa. In fact, I know that one of the attorneys who's been cited as a critic had a client in that same circumstance where he pled to a lesser offense. So it's not the unusual thing it's made out to be. The scope of this one was, that's clear, but the way it was handled legally and factually, not different than any other case.
Okay, Sonia Paris, in the minute we have before the break, address from your perspective the charges.
Well, I think that as the U.S. attorney said before, this was something that they worked on for several months, so it was very calculated, and it was, thought to be to put in place a fast track to get people out of the country as soon as possible. So, the issue with this is that these people were never allowed to have a fair hearing. Most of the clients that I work with thought that they were being punished for working without permission. They didn't even understand that they were being charged actually criminally, not with civil violations. They never had a chance to avail themselves to immigration remedies. And as a matter of fact, with the people that I worked that were left behind on humanitarian relief or were not apprehended, I was able to successfully represent more than 50 U visa applicants, which are visas that are given to victims of crimes of violence that are able to prove their cases. So a lot of people that were deported never availed themselves to this remedy, were never given a chance.
Sonia Paris, immigration lawyer, I know you can stay with us. Bob Teig, I don't know if you can stay on past the break.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things Sonia said that are wrong.
Okay. Bob Teig, former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Iowa at the time of the Postville raid 5 years ago, May 12th, 2008. Teig was involved with the planning of the raid and the prosecution. Sonia Paris, an immigration lawyer, represented around 200 people in relation to that raid. When we come back, we'll have some other guests with us as well, and we'd like to have your questions, your comments. Perhaps you were somehow connected with that Postville raid. You have a perspective or a question. 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a few minutes. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we hope to have a conversation that we'll record tomorrow morning with Kentucky Senator Rand Paul on our Politics Day to comprise part of the hour for tomorrow, Politics Day. And if you'd like to have a question to be considered for Rand Paul, perhaps you can post it on our Facebook page or send us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Senator Rand Paul on this program tomorrow. Today we're talking about the five-year anniversary of the Postville raid 5 years ago, May 12th, 2008. 2008, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers raided a kosher meatpacking plant in the northeast Iowa town of Postville, the largest immigration raid in Iowa's history, resulting in the deportation of over 300 people. From our first half hour, we have with us former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa at the time of the Postville raid. Bob Teig is with us. He was involved in the planning of the raid and the prosecution. Also with us, Sonia Paris, an immigration lawyer who represented around 200 people in relation to the Postville raid. They're with us. We want to have a couple of others join us in a couple of minutes, but Bob and Sonia, it's obvious you have two very different perspectives on what took place that day. Bob Teig, I wanted to go to you quickly you wanted to set the record straight according to what you heard from Sonia in the first half hour.
Yeah, and maybe I could ask her a couple questions. Also, I need to make sure the record's straight. I wasn't the United States attorney at the time. I was an assisting United States attorney.
Okay.
A difference of significance. That's okay. I don't want to claim any higher rank than I did have. Sonia, I assume you can hear me. Of those 150-some names, how many of those people had you ever talked to before and they'd agreed for you to be their attorney?
The family members hired us on their behalf.
Wasn't my question. How many of the detainees had ever agreed to have you be their attorney? It was none. Isn't that right?
It is true, but I don't need to have talked to anybody in order to enter my appearance as representative when I'm hired by a family member under immigration law, and I can have access to my clients as hired by family members under immigration law, yes.
Under immigration law. This wasn't immigration law. It was criminal law, was it? And you had no right to access in a criminal case. I think you even admitted that they were still being processed when you were there. It would have been impossible to get people to you with all the other activity. I think you'd acknowledge that. And then the next day you did get access to everyone you wanted to. Isn't that right?
No, that is not true. The first day they were being processed and they were being moved. The second days, I and my colleagues, my other six lawyer colleagues, part of a team, spent about 9 hours sitting in the trailer waiting for anybody to show up. And regardless of the proceedings, as a lawyer, if I am there to visit with my client, I have to have access to my client. We were not told what were the nature of the charges. We were not informed what were the nature of the procedures. We were only told that we could not have access to our clients. And it wasn't until we faxed a letter threatening to file a writ of habeas corpus in court the next morning at 8 in the morning that at 7 p.m. we got a call saying, oh, you can start seeing people now. We saw the first person at 2 in the morning.
Sonia Paris and Bob Teig, we have other people we'd like to get a little different perspective here. And I know there are a lot of complicated details, legal things going on here that we could recount actually all day.
Let me do just one quick one. They did have access to everybody before they left. When they found out they couldn't disrupt a criminal proceeding, they all left town. And they didn't go talk to these people when they could have, when they were housed openly.
That's inaccurate. We were there and we talked to only a few handful of them because they were being moved to federal
courts. Let me get your perspective here, too, because we have other guests waiting to join our conversation with other perspectives. Bob Teig, with all that you've said, you've defended the process in which this was done. In hindsight, was there any way in which this, and of course, in hindsight, you know, you can always improve on things. How might it have been done better now that you have the hindsight?
Well, really, for this size operation, I can't think of a way. It could have been done better, both from the enforcement side and from the defendant side. There were attorneys lined up to represent these people, and they represented many fewer than Sonia's 200, and none of them have complained that there wasn't a fair hearing. In fact, that's a bogus claim.
Mm-hmm.
There were fair hearings. None of them have claimed there was any unfairness. In fact, one of those lead attorneys is now getting ready to join the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals as a judge, and she has never said anything was wrong with the proceedings. So evidently, Sonia's got a little difference of opinion with the judge.
Sonia, let me ask you this question. To bring out the relevance of Postville, the Postville raid for today. What relevance do you see that this raid has for today's immigration debate, a comprehensive immigration reform that's being debated in Washington?
Well, I think that it is important to remember that the way the raids are carried have a very detrimental impact on our communities in general, in all of us. They disrupt communities and families. They infringe upon human rights oftentimes. They interfere with labor rights. You know, when enforcement is focused on punishing workers, it makes it easier for employers to hire and abuse undocumented workers. Workers are in constant fear of raids and are less likely, as we learned from Postville, to report unsafe working conditions or being victims of crimes. So in general, I think this is a good time to make sure that we help people liable, that we have a system that works, and that we remember that, again, you know, it is at the end of the day our communities, our economy that is impacted by raids and bad immigration policy.
Bob Tighe, can you find some agreement with Sonia Parris on that point?
I'm sorry, I got cut off a little.
I heard a click. I thought I was hoping you were still there. We're talking about the relevancy of this raid for today's immigration debate.
Sure.
Perhaps there's some common ground between the two of you there.
Well, obviously that's a subject of debate, and rightly so. But, you know, that's a policy issue for people that want to make the laws. Our office didn't have the luxury of being able to make the laws or say we want to change policies. We were charged with enforcing the laws. But there are problems that arise from illegal communities. One is when they're the victims of crimes by others in their community, even they won't report it to local authorities, and that was happening up at Postville. But the other thing I wanted to mention in relationship to the claim, well, there's jobs going begging for workers, so it's okay for illegal workers to work there. Postville opened up again, smaller scale, but the people are not from the United States, but they're not illegal workers anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me introduce a couple of other guests. If you just joined us, Bob Tighe is with us, a former deputy U.S. attorney for the—
Assistant.
Boy. Okay. I'm going to hope I don't get three strikes next time I say that. Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa at the time of the Postville raid, and also with us, Sonia Parris, an immigration lawyer who represented many people in the Postville raid. I want to welcome also to our conversation David Vasquez. He is a campus pastor at Luther College in Decorah. David, welcome to our program.
Thank you for the opportunity to be in conversation.
And David, I understand you worked as an advocate for the immigrants in Postville, directly involved with some family reunification issues. Aaron Goldsmith is also with us, a member of Postville's Jewish community, served on the council from 2000 to 2003, and you are the author of the book Postville, USA, Surviving Diversity in Small Town America. Let's go to you quickly, each of you, for your perspectives. David Vasquez, tell us about family reunification. This is one of the real human sides of the story. First of all, give us an example of how family members became separated in this process.
In any enforcement, particularly one that is as violent and as forceful as the one in Postville, we're talking about a town of 2,400 people. I don't know if listeners can imagine this. It's a town that's about 10 blocks by 20 blocks. About 1,100 is the estimate of enforcement personnel that came into town. So, you know, sort of one to for every two people in town. And they were over the top armed as if they were pursuing, terrorists or something, descending on people who were doing work for the day. So the first impact in the way that people were torn apart is just the use of force, the over-the-top enforcement that really did not seem like a good use of our resources as a nation to undermine that community. People were torn apart by the economic impact, not only on the immigrants, but on the whole community. Sorry to hear Mr. Tighe believes that the company just went on its merry way or recovered quickly. The reality is the company went bankrupt, and it took a long time before they were able to then, under new management, begin to function. I cannot, like he has done, testify to the status of the current workers in terms of their immigration status. I don't know that I would say that they are all, have documentation to be able to work in the United States. This is an issue across the entire industry.
David Vasquez, tell me about the reunification of the families and the hurdles you faced there.
And all of these things, economic impact, devastation of the community, tore people apart from each other, both immigrants and people in the community. 307 people were deported from the community or removed from the community. Many of them, most of them, spent time in detention for 5 months. And that tore their families apart. And then some people, because of the way that this was prosecuted, that it ended up with a criminal felony charge, it means that even some of the people who have been able to, since the raid, qualify for to remain in the country, have a very difficult uphill battle to try to reunite with their families because some of their family members now have a felony on their record. And so that bars them from reentering the country unless they're able to bypass us, which is...
Where are these over 300 people now deported back to their home countries?
The majority of them were from Guatemala and then a large number also from Mexico. Some of them, their families remained here. Some of them, again, had children who were U.S. born citizens. And so, you know, the enforcement of immigration throughout the country is tearing a lot of our families apart.
Aaron Goldsmith, you're a member of Postville's Jewish community, author of Postville's USA Surviving Diversity in Small Town American. Remind us, the listeners who don't know, how the Orthodox Jewish community became established in Postville briefly.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. And I just wanted to mention that Mark Gray and Michelle Devlin, both professors at UNI, co-authored the book with me.
And thank you.
We felt that we needed that kind of unity and that diversity of background to lay the record straight and lay the whole picture straight and to talk about what the destruction that was wrought by this this raid. I feel sorry for Mr. Teague because right now he's trying to paint a pretty picture on something that to me is it speaks for itself about how the over-prosecution of this case was completely didn't bring any real remedy, didn't affect anything positive, and there's no value outcome from all of this. And the deepest, darkest truth is that if this was such a good idea and such a good process, we would have seen it occur 20 times since. The fact is that they've basically stopped this kind of a type of raid because it's futile. They spent millions and millions of dollars and broke up much, much more. The cure was much worse than the illness.
Mm-hmm. Former Eger Processor CEO Shalom Rabashkin was convicted on 86 charges of financial fraud, charges on immigration and child labor dropped, sentenced to 27 years in federal maximum security prison, ordered to pay, I think, over $25 million in restitution. What is the Jewish community's view on punishment for him, and should it perhaps have been directed primarily at the top?
Well, you know what, it's, I can't speak to the fact that laws are broken, and that's something that every person has to make peace with. But I think even Mr. Teague would agree with me that the kind of a sentence that he received was just outrageous. And I know that Mr. Teague had no control over the jury instructions.
It's Bob Teig. It's Bob Teig, by the way.
I apologize for Bob Teig. But I think I don't even think we'd understand that a first-time offender, no matter what you say, that is spending virtually a life sentence in the courtroom, they didn't allow. He has an autistic son that he went home every night to work with and talk with, and this was, wasn't allowed to be said in front of a jury. This is a jury that unanimously noted on their ballot that he didn't do this for personal gain, that he tried to keep his company alive, and the community cannot understand why he's sitting 27 years for this kind of a crime when commensurate crimes are usually 1 to 3 years. And even an official from the same bank who embezzled $30 or $35 million from the same bank and did it for selfish gain received a minor sentence. So it's very, very hard to justify a 27-year sentence. It's unfathomable, and it's just another tragedy of this raid that is emblematic of what's wrong with Washington. And it's not the prosecutor's fault that he's given a duty to do it, but just simply makes no sense what they did, and it didn't bring any value or any positive outcomes.
Okay, Aaron Goldsmith, in light of your comments and those of David Vasquez, I feel I need to go to Bob Teig.
Absolutely.
And have him reply briefly to what's been said.
And first, is Pastor Vasquez, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to have to say this, but you should be ashamed of some of your comments. You've misled people. There was no use of force. No one was injured. They had people there in case someone was injured because of the sharp knives on scene, but they didn't have to use those medical facilities. No one was hurt. There were humanitarian steps taken so that no child who was at school would be left without a parent. Anyone who said, I have a child I have to take care of, was let go to take care of that child. You didn't say those things. You made misstatements about force. I'm sorry to have to call you on that, but I have to. Now, Mr. Goldsmith, you not only got my name wrong, you got many more things wrong. Mr. Rubashkin's crime and what he did is not the same as everybody else. It was hard for him to earn that 27-year sentence. That's not easy to do in the federal system. And how he did it was the scope of his crime, several million dollars, the fact that he lied at trial. After taking an oath to tell the truth, he lied. He got people to destroy evidence for him.
All that led to
his sentence. It wasn't outrageous. It's something he had to work very hard on to earn. So there have been those mistakes and those misstatements out there. And to say the fact of an autistic child should enter into this, I have an autistic child. That has nothing to do with anything I do. And I am offended that you would say that should have made some kind of impact with the jury.
Shame on you.
I hear David and Aaron trying to get in on this. We have a limited time. Bob, thank you for
your... We didn't find out what toppings were on the pizza that the prosecutor was so worried about.
We don't have a lot of time. A quick response there, and I'd like to sort of look forward after you respond to what Bob Tye just said.
This is David Vasquez again. Mr. Tiger, I was present immediately after the raid. I have spoken and have testimony that has been sworn by several people who were physically attacked during the raid, who were grabbed by the hair, who were insulted. The physical presence of weapons and the large numbers that were there represents an act of violence.
If
the
drawn.
Way that we approach our laws is only when the fire, you know, when people are physically, you know, that if we don't recognize the violence of the presence of weaponry in the way that it was present in that town, the fear that that left, not only on the immigrants, but the entire community speaks for itself.
Pastor, they weren't drawn.
Yes, they were, sir. I was present at the site. I'm not sure if you were, but I was present at the site. I've spoken with hundreds of people who were present at the site, and if we have the opportunity, we can share those at another occasion.
Okay, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to ascertain exactly the picture here. Thank you for your views on that, but I want to get a picture from you, Aaron Goldsmith, and David Vasquez of what is Postville like today? 5 years afterwards, how has the community changed and recovered from the raid? Aaron, would you go first, please?
I'd be happy to do it. What was right about Postville before is right about Postville now. The people of Postville have character. The people of Postville have tried to bring work with the cards they've been dealt, and they're moving forward. And it was a tremendous testimony to the broader community that after we went through the fiasco and the suffering that we did from the hands of this raid, that there was no incidents of people beating up each other. There was no incidents of any sort of graffiti, any anti-Semitism, any sort of things that might bubble up in Europe and other places. Here was everybody pick the pieces up and start to work on putting back together our town, putting back again our community, and trying to pick up the pieces of what I still believe is being misportrayed by the prosecutor was an outrageous raid.
Mm-hmm. The population of Postville still down from its top in 2008 to how many now approximately, do you know?
I believe the broader numbers of the community and the Jewish community are probably 30% or 30 to 35% down overall.
Okay.
Ben, excuse me, I'd agree with many of those things.
Okay,
as far as the after the fact, what's happening in Postville.
Okay.
And the Rubashkins did go bankrupt, but somebody else came in, and they're now running the plant legally.
Okay. Bob Tighe, I want to get a vision. I asked you this question beforehand, Bob Tighe, so let me ask David Vasquez the relevancy of what happened 5 years ago in Postville for our current immigration debate. What does it say about it?
Postville, I've often said, is a microcosm of what's wrong with a broken immigration system. I do feel for those who find themselves in the position of trying to enforce a broken system. It definitely places people in very difficult ethical and professional positions. We have a broken system, and it's obvious in a community that provides a microcosm where we can see the economic, personal, physical impact of enforcing laws that just do not reflect our current economic needs and opportunities. I have served on a task force for the Midwest that has included, it has been led by former Governor Chet, Iowa Governor, Culver, mm-hmm. and also a former mayor from Chicago, Richard Daley, that looked at the future of the Midwest and its economic future tied to immigration. Our economic needs in the Midwest are very different, perhaps, from those of the border and other areas, and they need to be taken into consideration as we look forward, to move forward together with immigration. And so I think that the Postville raid speaks both to what's broken with the system and how enforcement is not a way forward. It destroys communities. It undermines our values.
Okay.
On the other hand, Postville is also a microcosm of what can be done well, in the same way that I would echo what was just spoken by Mr. Goldsmith, of the fact that Postville represents also the fabric of the Midwest, a community that is able to incorporate people, to integrate, and to bring about transformation.
David Vasquez, we have to go. Campus pastor at Luther College in Decorah, Aaron Goldsmith, member of Postville's Jewish Community, author, along with two other co-authors mentioned, of Postville, USA. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, David, for joining us. Bob Tighe, thank you for joining us and giving us your perspective as well.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it. Do it again.
All right. Bob Tighe and Sonia Paras with us as well. Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help from John Pemble in Des Moines. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Rand Paul on the program tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.